Chapter 5, Continued. Aligning incentives. Say, for example, government funding makes up 20% of a business's income, directly or indirectly. On many issues, that business is going to be far more interested in keeping the government happy than focused on pleasing the individual consumers. And this perversion would only get worse as the government raises its level of involvement. Eventually, individual consumers would become nothing more than an afterthought. As I mentioned before at the start of this chapter, this strategy was clearly stated in Klaus Schwab's article outlining his main components of the Great Reset, published in June 2020. The second component of the Great Reset agenda, he says, quote, would ensure that investments advance shared goals such as equality and sustainability, rather than using these funds as well as investments from private entities and pension funds to fill the cracks in the old system, we should use them to create a new one that is more resilient, equitable, and sustainable in the long run. This means, for example, building green urban infrastructure and creating incentives for industries to improve their track record on environmental, social, and governance metrics. Another much less misleading word for the incentives Klaus speaks about here is coercion. And if enough money is tied to ESG metrics, that coercion could effectively become necessary to businesses in order for them to survive, especially if it is coupled with the all-new taxes and regulations Schwab and other Great Resetters also support. Additionally, it is important to note that the Great Resetters do not always use the words environmental, social, and governance metrics. When they're referring to building their new stakeholder economy, they might use terms like sustainable investment and realigning incentives to convey the same radical idea. Writing for WEF and Project Syndicate in July 2020, Tallulah Oni, a physician and researcher at the University of Cambridge, said, quote, although several global philanthropic initiatives have sought to improve urban health and resilience, undoubtedly with positive results, today's flawed systems need more fundamental disruption. Simply put, the world needs a new Marshall Plan for planetary health, akin to a New Deal for a post-pandemic recovery. According to Oni, this new Marshall Plan would serve as a global guide aligning incentives and shifting default behaviors toward the shared goal of sustainable, healthy urban development. It will require the agreement and participation of national and local governments, private developers, investors, and multilateral organizations, which will take time. Aligning incentives and shifting default behaviors is another way of saying bribing businesses to do what we think is in the best interest of the collective or in line with ESG goals. This is exactly what Great Reset supporter Sharon Burrow, the General Secretary of the International Trade Union Confederation, had in mind when she said during an interview about the Great Reset, we need to design policies to align with investment in people and the environment. But above all, the longer-term perspective is about rebalancing economies, end quote. Now, she elaborated further in the interview saying, quote, we want an end to the profit-at-all-costs mentality, because if we don't build an economic future within a sustainable framework in which we are respectful of our planetary boundaries, the need to change our energy and technology systems, then we will not have a living planet for human beings, end quote. This is the same sort of thinking used by the French government in 2020 when crafting COVID-19 relief packages for airlines suffering under government lockdowns. As reported by The Guardian in April 2020, quote, some governments are seeking to attach strings to rescue plans. France's Minister for Ecological Transition, Elizabeth Borne, insisted Air France was not getting a blank check. The government had set ecological commitments, she said, including a 50% reduction in carbon emissions on domestic flights by 2024, as well as investing in more fuel-efficient planes, end quote. Many financial institutions have already laid the groundwork for punishing companies that will not go along with the Great Reset mandates. In February 2021, Bank of America, citing its, quote, long-standing support for the Paris Climate Agreement, issued a press release announcing that it had, quote, outlined initial steps to achieve its goal of net zero greenhouse gas emissions in all of its financing activities, operations, and supply chain before 2050, end quote. The press release further noted, Bank of America continues to actively engage with its clients to help accelerate their own transitions to net zero, and it plans to establish interim science-based emission targets for high-emitting portfolios, including energy and power. In addition, Bank of America released its broader 2030 operational and supply chain goals as part of a holistic commitment to environmental sustainability. End quote. Notice that Bank of America's goal of net zero greenhouse gas GHG emissions applies not only to the company's operations and supply chain, which means that everyone who does business with Bank of America would have to go along with its goals in order to keep Bank of America as a customer, but also to the bank's financing activities, which is another way of saying, if you don't go green, we're not going to give your business a loan. In the same press release, Bank of America also touted the close relationship its CEO Brian Moynihan has with the World Economic Forum and its involvement with the development of WEF's ESG metrics. And then it included this creepy quote from Bank of America Vice Chairman Anne Finucane, who, according to the press release, leads the company's environmental, social, and governance, sustainable finance, capital deployment, and public policy efforts. Quote, it is critical that we leverage all parts of our business beyond our direct operations in order to accelerate the transition to a net zero global economy. We recognize that this will be no easy task, but we believe our commitment will help spur the growth of zero carbon energy and power solutions, sustainable transportation and agriculture, and other sector transformations while generating more climate resilient and equitable opportunities for our future. Wow. That sounds awfully similar to the exact same kind of thing you might hear while attending a Great Reset meeting in Davos. Again, pay special attention to what a Bank of America is saying here. Its plan to leverage all parts of our business beyond our direct operations in order to accelerate the transition to a net zero global economy. In other words, the plan is to push the world towards elite's goals of a global economy that has net zero carbon dioxide emissions, whether the world wants it or not, by using the full weight and power of one of the wealthiest, most influential banks on earth. Here's where it gets scary. Bank of America is hardly the only private financial institution pushing ESG standards and green energy mandates. In March 2021, Jane Fraser, the CEO of Citi, a bank worth more than $200 billion, published an article on the company's website titled Citi's Commitment to Net Zero by 2050. In the article, Fraser declared, the climate crisis is among the top critical challenges facing our global society and economy today, and there is an urgent need for collective action. We believe that global financial institutions like Citi have the opportunity and the responsibility to play a leading role in help driving the transition to net zero global economy and make good on the promise of the Paris Agreement. So how does Fraser envision Citi, quote, helping drive the transition to net zero global economy? Well, after bragging about various actions that Citi has taken to reduce its own carbon footprint and to facilitate financing for low carbon solutions, Fraser wrote, quote, our ESG agenda cannot be a separate layer that sits above what we do day to day. Our commitment to closing the gender pay gap, to advancing racial equity, to pioneer the green agenda, have demonstrated this is good for business and not at odds with it. And we will continue to be part of the solution to these challenges and enable others to do so as well. Quote, net zero means rethinking our business and helping our clients rethink theirs. For banks, What some don't realize is that net zero includes not just our own operations, but also our core business impacts, including the bank's financing activities, end quote. Years in the making. It is not a coincidence that the announcement from Citi's CEO about the bank's commitment to shift forward a model that will eventually limit financing opportunities to a business that fits its ESG framework came within a month of Bank of America issuing a nearly identical promise. Thanks to a swift shove from the government, the world's financial institutions have been moving in this direction now for many years. As Ian Murray, the Vice President for Strategy and Senior Fellow of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, reported back in 2014 for The Blaze, firearms sellers, pawn shops, payday lenders, even porn stars around the nation have recently found their bank accounts canceled despite years of a good relationship with their banks. When pressed, the banks say it's because of heightened regulatory supervision of high-risk industries. This can be traced back to a shadowy Obama administration program launched in 2013 called Operation Choke Point. Operation Choke Point is a Department of Justice-led initiative aimed at choking off the financial oxygen of potential financial fraudsters who use third-party payment processors to process payments. It does this based on a 2011 guidance document from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, otherwise known as the FDIC, on how banks should manage their relationships with TPPPs that deal with industries that might present, quote, a reputational risk to the bank. Until recently, that guidance contained a list of about 30 high-risk industries, including ammunition, drug paraphernalia, pornography, home-based charities, and many others. Once the public found out about Operation Choke Point, the backlash caused the leadership at the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation to withdraw its list of high-risk industries. But Murray noted Operation Choke Point continued, just in a slightly different guise. He explains, the underlying guidance about reputational risk remains unchanged. All the government has done is remove examples of what might constitute such a risk from its websites. As a result, banks now have to judge for themselves what constitutes that sort of reputational risk that could trigger a federal subpoena. Meanwhile, Justice Department attorneys are using their own judgment about reputational risk to serve as a basis for whom to investigate. If today's focus is on payday lenders, who's to say, for example, that pornography will not be the next industry to come under the spotlight? What about a coal company? When so many are now convinced that coal pollutes the planet and the nation should move toward renewable energy. Although Operation Choke Point was eventually disbanded by the Trump administration in 2017, a clear signal had been sent to the banks and other financial institutions. Don't do business with industries disfavored by many in the federal government. Now, around the same time that 195 countries signed the Paris Climate Agreement in 2015, thereby committing to dramatically reduce their carbon dioxide emissions, banks and financial institutions around the world, with Operation Choke Point and other similar policies in mind, began to shift their focus heavily towards concerns over climate change or how they could better position their businesses in a post-Paris Agreement world. It started with the development of the Partnership for Carbon Accounting Financials, PCAF. It began in 2015. The PCAF members, which include commercial banks, development banks, asset owners, managers, insurance companies, etc., collaborate, quote, to develop and implement greenhouse gas accounting in their organizations, end quote, as well as help spur discussions on climate change and the role of the financial institution to facilitate the transition towards a low-carbon society, end quote. PCAF-compliant financial institutions numbered more than 100 as of March 2021 and include some of the largest institutions in America, such as Bank of America, Citi, Morgan Stanley, and TD Bank. Gee, weren't those some of the banks that were meeting at that train station to go duck hunting? Following the signing of the Paris Agreement, banks and financial institutions work together to further develop and expand rules, regulations, and guidelines to transform their industries, culminating in the formation of 2019 and the UN Principles for Responsible Banking, the first, quoting, ever global sustainability framework for the banking industry. PRB signatories commit to align their business strategy and practice with the Sustainable Development Goals and the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement. Or to put more simply, signatories agree to stop financing any business that refused to adopt the elite's climate change mandates. As of September 2020, more than 190 banks had agreed to the principles for responsible banking, and these signatories look after the business of more than 1.6 billion customers worldwide and represent around 40% of all global banking assets, end quote. However, fear of government mandates is not the only thing banks and financial institutions had in mind when they started building their Great Reset ESG frameworks. Perhaps most important of all is the promise of cold, hard cash. The payoff. It is important to understand that the most corrupt and terrifying elements of the Great Reset also help explain why so many business leaders and financial institutions have agreed to promote this movement. Many have gone beyond mere promotion and even helped develop some of its primary components. This includes the presidents and CEOs from Microsoft, Bank of America, MasterCard, British Petroleum, and other highly influential businesses and investment firms. 347. The crony corporatists running these multi-billion dollar companies have seen the writing on the wall. Governments around the world are increasingly pushing for green mandates and sustainable development, as well as restrictions on speech, whether business and their customers like it or not. Plus, central banks are literally printing trillions of dollars that governments are directing toward the causes they favor, including many focused on social justice. So if you're running a business, especially a huge multinational corporation, it would be stupid not to do everything in your power to get your hands on some of that free cash, right? It is also worth noting that many investors and businesses are not waiting around for what they believe to be the inevitable rise of ESG standards and increased government action. Investors and large corporations do not merely plan 12 months into the future. They plan 12 years into the future. Instead of utilizing potentially catastrophic wait-and-see approaches, they are adopting policies now with the hopes that it will put them in the good graces of the money-printing overlords in central banks and governments all across the planet, including the United States. Nowhere has this been made clearer than in the presentations and articles posted to the website of the Principles for Responsible Investment, PRI Group. It's one of the world's most influential advocates for adopting ESG standards. In 2005, the United Nations brought together a group of 20 influential investors from 12 different countries, as well as 70 experts from the investment industry, to develop the Principles for Responsible Investment. Now, according to PRI, the six principles for responsible investment are a voluntary and aspirational set of investment principles that offer a menu of possible actions for incorporating ESG issues into investment practice. The principles were developed by investors, for investors. In implementing them, signatories contribute to the developing of a more sustainable global finance system. When PRI officially launched in 2006, there was a total of 100 signatories. Today, there are more than 3,000, and together they control more than $100 trillion in assets. Yes, you read that correctly, $100 trillion. Although PRI is officially independent, it continues to work very closely with the United Nations and other Great Reset allies. And even though it is a purely voluntary association, it openly acknowledges that it fully expects governments to demand in the near future many of the so-called sustainable principles that it supports. Even more important, PRI investors are convinced that governments and central banks will soon start shoveling even more cash into the coffers of those businesses that agree to sign on to the Great Reset agenda. You don't need to be a genius to see that the Principles for Responsible Investment Group is more concerned with finding ways to profit off of cronyism and government mandates than fighting climate change or battling income inequality. In a section of PRI's website titled, "What is the Inevitable Policy Response?" PRI states that it is inevitable that governments will be forced to act more decisively than they have so far on the issue of climate change. Quote, "The question for investors now is not if governments will act," PRI claims, "but when they will do so, what policies they will use, and where the impact will be most felt." The IPR, Inevitable Policy Response Project, forecasts a response by 2025 that, quote, "will be forceful, abrupt, and disorderly because of the delay," end quote. 352. PRI then goes on to encourage its investors to focus on putting money into companies, projects, and other investments that are closely aligned with green energy. Why? It's because PRI is full of people desperate to win the love and affection of Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. No, it's not that. It's because green energy projects are where the government-printed modern monetary theory money will go under Joe Biden and many other government administrations around the world over the next several years. The Big Three. Now, it's tempting to think that government is the primary driver of corporations' move towards ESG and other woke causes, and it has undoubtedly played a significant role. However, perhaps the biggest reason so many corporations have agreed to adopt Great Reset principles in recent years is because of the voting power and influence of large Wall Street investment management companies, not the authority of government agencies. In the previous section, I explained investors are promoting ESG in part because they believe government regulations and spending programs are moving in that direction, and they don't want to be left behind when the Great Reset is fully in place. Corporations looking to attract new investors and raise their stock prices are reworking their business models to please these investors. But that is only part of the story. In many cases, corporations are effectively being forced to change by powerful investment groups. Now, how can an investment management firm coerce a giant company to enact radical new corporate policies, including ESG scoring systems? Well, by owning so much stock that they can alter corporate policies through shareholder resolutions, or even replace corporate board members who refuse to go along with the Great Reset. The consolidation of stock ownership in the hands of a small group of investment management companies is a relatively new and exceedingly dangerous development. The three largest stock index fund managers, BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street Global Advisors, have quadrupled their average combined stake in S&P 500 companies over the past two decades. According to research by Lucian Bebchuk, a professor at Harvard Law School, and Scott Hurst, an associate professor at Boston University School of Law, the average ownership stake of the Big Three investment firms was 5.2% in 1998. By 2017, it was 20.5%. Even more important, the Big Three collectively cast an average of about 25% of the votes at S&P 500 companies. That means when the three big firms demand that corporate America jumps, most CEOs can respond with only, how high? This consolidation of voting power is likely to get worse in the coming years. Bebchuk and Hurst believe that, quote, the Big Three could well cast as much as 40% of the votes in the S&P 500 companies within another two decades. If that were to occur, three Wall Street firms working in conjunction with a relatively small group of other shareholders could effectively control nearly all of corporate America. Although the influence of the big three has yet to reach the 40% mark, many corporations today are effectively controlled by a combination of the 10 investment groups and financial institutions with the most assets under management. Collectively, the total assets controlled by the Big Ten investment groups, a list that includes Goliaths like J.P. Morgan Chase, Fidelity, and Goldman Sachs, are worth more than $34 trillion. Again, let me put that number into perspective. America spent $12.5 trillion on goods and services in 2020. The total U.S. GDP in 2020 was less than $21 trillion. Remember, they have the investment power of $34 trillion. Many of the largest asset managers are deeply involved in the ESG movement, and some have openly supported the Great Reset. For example, Lawrence Fink, the CEO of BlackRock. He's on the board of directors of the World Economic Forum. He is a vocal proponent of the reset. State Street's global advisor, the folks who installed the Fearless Girl statue from across Wall Street's bull statue as a publicity stunt in 2017, they launched a widespread campaign in 2017 to force companies to have more women on their board of directors. The move was part of the company's strong commitment to ESG standards. In 2018, the publication Institutional Investor reported State Street expanded the policy and said it will vote against the entire slate of board members on the nominating committee of any company not meeting its gender diversity criteria. According to the Institutional Investor as of 2018, State Street says that more than 300 companies have added a female board of director in response to its demands, and that another 28 have pledged to do so. Additionally, it is important to note that every one of the top largest asset managers have signed the Principles for Responsible Investment. As is often the case, if you still want to truly understand why big corporations or large government agencies act the way they do, follow the money. Shifting standards. Now, even if you happen to believe that banks and investment management groups should be shoving other businesses towards green energy and other environmental causes, it's important to remember the fluid nature of ESG standards. As I discussed earlier, many of the metrics in ESG systems revolve around environmental causes. But this doesn't mean that's where it ends. ESG elites have begun to add metrics that punish businesses who work with some weapons manufacturers. How long before firearm manufacturers and sellers lose access to business loans or other services because banks are worried about their precious ESG score falling by a point or two? How long before fast food giants and soda manufacturers are deemed just too dangerous for the public health? Once the full ESG system imagined by great resetters is firmly in place, no business or industry will be able to survive the ire of the ruling class elites who run it. Even individual politicians could be targeted. In 2021, Americans witnessed some of the earliest attempts by the banks to use their power to punish specific political figures in the United States. According to a report by Bloomberg.com, officials at Deutsche Bank and New York-based Signature Bank said in January 2021, they will no longer do business with Donald Trump, despite both banks' long-standing relationships with the Trump family and its businesses. According to the banks, the decision was based on political matters, not financial concerns, end quote. Even more stunning, Bloomberg.com further reported Signature Bank announced it will not do business in the future with any members of Congress who voted to disregard the Electoral College, referring to members of the U.S. House and Senate who questioned the validity of the 2020 presidential races in several states, after evidence emerged pointing to the possibility of voter fraud. Other industries and large corporations have also engaged now in the targeting of individuals. Shortly after the January 6, 2021 riots at the U.S. Capitol, book publisher Simon & Schuster, announced the cancellation of Senator Josh Hawley's book, The Tyranny of Big Tech. In Simon & Schuster's announcement, they vaguely alluded to Hawley's demands for investigations into potential voter fraud occurring during the 2020 presidential election as the primary reason for the cancellation. Simon & Schuster also suggested that by demanding election investigations, Hawley had helped to encourage the riots, a ludicrous assertion. Even more troubling, courts will likely do very little to stop ESG's infringement of individual liberties because ESG standards don't necessarily need to be controlled by the government directly. So whenever international elites want to manipulate society, silence political opponents, or engage in otherwise horrifying, tyrannical behavior, all they have to do is, under the ESG system, add another metric or two to the global ESG framework, and they could effectively nullify free speech, an issue I discuss more extensively later on. The right to keep and bear arms, or the number of constitutionally protected rights, and all of this could be accomplished without the consent of the American people. Your very own ESG score. Some might be tempted to think, yeah, well, I'm not a politician, I'm not a gun rights group or an oil company, I don't have anything to worry about. This is a massive mistake. If banks and other financial institutions can target well-funded special interest groups, President Donald Trump, and sitting members of Congress, some of the most powerful and influential people in the world, what makes you believe that they would think twice about debanking or silencing or punishing you, regardless of your political views, if you belong to a political group or club or organization, association, a religion, or business considered to be standing in the way of the elite goals? The framework for providing ESG scores to Main Street Americans, not just big companies, has already been built. You might have an investment account for your 401k or savings or whatever, but I want you to look at it, because most likely you have received an ESG score without you even knowing it. In March 2021, a friend of mine who works for a small think tank and well acquainted with the Great Reset, let's call him Chris, yeah, that's his name, reached out to my staff after he discovered that his account with Merrill Lynch, one of the world's largest investment services companies and subsidiary of Bank of America, had been given an ESG score. The score had been formulated by examining the ESG scores of the various companies Chris had invested in. Now, Chris is just a regular guy with a 401k retirement account. He's young. He doesn't have an investment portfolio that's overflowing with cash. He's just a regular, hardworking guy, probably very similar to a lot of people reading this book right now. He never asked for his investments to be given an ESG score. And when he found it, he wasn't happy, to say the least. To find out his ESG score was an abysmal 4.7 out of 10, what a degenerate. But Merrill Lynch gave him an ESG score anyway, because they're just such nice people over there, and they always offer guidance on how Chris should, you know, how Chris could improve his accounts, you know, and his ESG score in the future. And, you know, heck, I'm sure they're going to stop by Chris's house and help him with his golf game, too. Are you getting nervous yet? Because you should be. In full disclosure, my research team has been contacted by a very large financial institution that wasn't happy with the warnings about ESG scores that I have issued on my radio and television shows. The bank, which I'll not name here because the conversation was off the record, controls hundreds of billions of dollars in assets. Now, the financial institution's main complaint was not that my reporting on ESG scores has been factually inaccurate, but rather that my fears about ESG scores are overblown. In conversations with my staff, bank officials insisted that they were not forcing individual investors to do anything based on an account's ESG score, and that is true for now. But the most terrifying part of the Great Reset's ESG system is not what they're doing today, although there's plenty there to worry about, to be sure. It's what could be done with these ESG scores and other similar metrics in the future. The framework to manipulate and control the economy is being built right now. Much of it has been in place for years, and we didn't even know it. A huge number of the world's largest, wealthiest corporations have already bought into the ESG system. They have employees who spend most of their days conducting international audits related specifically to ESG scoring. CEOs from all over the world are regularly working with groups like the World Economic Forum to expand and refine the ESG scores. The SEC, as we've already shown, is now getting involved with ESG reporting and beginning the process of issuing ESG-related regulations. S&P Global, the organization that produces the S&P 500 and Dow Jones Industrial Average stock indexes, now even has an S&P 500 ESG stock index. Investment companies like Merrill Lynch have started providing the individual investors, even people with relative small accounts, with ESG scores based on the stock and the index funds they have invested in. Bank of America, Citi, and other large banks have said that they are going to use their considerable wealth and power to accelerate the transition to a net zero global economy, in part by requiring their finance activities, operations, and supply chain go green. President Trump, special interest groups, and members of Congress have been banned from doing business with some banks and retailers now because of their political views. Politicians and pundits, some of which have millions of followers, have been banned or censored on social media platforms, a problem we will discuss at length in the next section. They lost this platform because they were just speaking out about the possibility of election fraud or for questioning the justification given by elites for stopping people from attending church services in the midst of a pandemic, while also encountering protesters who take to the streets by the tens of thousands to demand social justice. China has already developed and started to roll out a social credit system that includes a set of databases and initiatives that monitor and assess the trustworthiness of individuals, companies, and government entities. According to the South China Morning Post, each entry, meaning a human being, is given a social credit score with reward for those who have high ratings and punishments for those with low scores. 367. Businesses in China also are subjected to a credit scoring system. Business entities, including foreign businesses in China, are subject to a corporate credit system, tracking information such as tax payments, bank load repayments, and employment disputes, the Morning Post also reported. And who are the key people in charge of running China's social credit system? Government bureaucrats and banks. According to the Morning Post, the databases are managed by China's economic planner, the National Development and Reform Commission, the People's Bank of China, and the country's court system. Any of this sound familiar to you? I mean, it's almost like Klaus Schwab took his ESG playbook directly from China, or that China took Schwab's ideas, which have been around for more than 50 years, and put them into action long before anyone in America had ever heard of environmental, social, and governance metrics. In our modern world, which is full of authoritarian power grabs and growing divide between ruling class and elites and everyone else, endless money printing, golden opportunity pandemics, a dishonest media, and the emergence of an authoritarian China as a global superpower, you would have to be certifiably insane if you weren't at least a little concerned about the possibility of every regular Joe and Jane in America receiving a score measuring how closely their investment decisions align with those of the ruling class. Big tech tyrants. Much of the Great Reset is focused on economic changes, but it would be a huge mistake to think that resetters are not interested in making expansive alterations to other parts of society as well. As the head of WEF, Klaus Schwab, wrote in 2020, quote, to achieve a better outcome, the world must act jointly and swiftly to revamp all aspects of our society and economies from education to social contracts and working conditions, end quote. So what exactly does Schwab and other resetters have in mind when they make these far-reaching statements? At the very least, it includes left-wing ideas about enhancing social justice, as countless articles published on the World Economic Forum's website illustrates. In October 2020, David Sangakoya, the head of the WEF's Civil Society Communities and Social Justice Initiatives, authored an article titled "Social Justice, Inclusion, and Sustainable Development Need a Great Reset. Here are the three steps we can take." In the article, Sangakoya summarizes the findings of the September 2020 WEF meeting of more than 3,800 leaders from government, business, and civil society called the Sustainable Development Impact Summit. According to Sangakoya, sessions held at the summit on social justice were of significant interest to business leaders navigating the ramifications of the pandemic and how to define their stakeholder responsibilities to social justice and sustainability. Sangakoya then describes the three key takeaways from the summit on, quote, driving a great reset in social justice, inclusion, and sustainable development impact, including this one, quote, widespread environmental crisis and global Black Lives Matter protests have sparked palpable restlessness for change. There is a need to accelerate both sustainability and social justice agendas from both employees and consumers, end quote. Of course, over the last few years, we've learned that one of the ways corporations can accelerate social justice agendas is to stifle the free speech of anyone who stands in the way of the Great Reset or any other cause embraced by the elites. That's why the Great Reset agenda includes the WEF's Global Alliance for Responsible Media. Man, they never seem to run out of new Orwellian names for their little authoritarian clubs, do they? The purpose of the Global Alliance for Responsible Media is to partner corporations and advertisers with publishers and platforms to do more to address harmful and misleading media environments, and to develop and deliver against a concrete set of actions, processes, and protocols for protecting brands. In between the time of this writing and this recording, Sports Illustrated just announced their new swimsuit issue, and you can only advertise in it if your company has made a commitment to the progress of women. According to WEF, among the perceived problems publishers and platforms need to do more to address are bullying, hate speech, and disinformation, all of which are words regularly used by elites to unfairly smear, well, just about anyone who doesn't agree with their own vision for the world. By the way, another reason why you should order this book in paperback or in hardcover now. Some European countries have already started requiring social media companies to restrict free speech. In May 2020, CNN reported, the French parliament passed a controversial hate speech law that would fine social media companies if they failed to remove certain illegal content within 24 hours, and in some cases, as little as 1 hour. CNN further reported the new regulation calls for the tech platforms to remove hateful comments based on race, religion, sexual orientation, gender, or disability, as well as sexual harassment, within 24 hours after they are flagged by users. Companies that fail to comply with the 24-hour rule would be fined as much as $1.36 million per violation. But there would be no fines if platforms permanently remove content that is later deemed acceptable. Oh, end quote. The law was based on similar legislation already in place in Germany, the Network Enforcement Act, which mandates that social media companies remove hate speech and fake news within 24 hours of it being flagged, or face penalties of up to roughly $60 million, according to CNN. They also must publish reports every 6 months detailing the number of complaints of illegal content they have received. Court struck down much of the French law in June 2020 for violating the country's constitution, but that hasn't stopped some affiliated with the World Economic Forum from continuing to promote similar mandates. WEF continues to display on its website a March 2018 article titled, How Technology Can Be Used to Combat Online Hate Speech, authored by La Trobe University lecturer André Obler. In the article, Obler suggests that government should follow the lead of Germany in imposing financial penalties on major social media companies if they fail to reduce the volume of abusive content on their platforms, end quote. Obler further said, we must develop ways of correctly identifying and measuring the amount of abusive content being posted and removed to ensure that companies are complying. Although it's unlikely such a law would survive a challenge in the U.S. Supreme Court, it is vital to remember that a model like the one proposed by supporters of the Great Reset would work around the free speech protections guaranteed by our First Amendment because it would not mandate that companies do anything to stop free speech. It would just heavily coerce them into eliminating speech until they effectively have no choice but to act in line with the demands of the ruling class. It's not hard to imagine how Great Reset ideas about limiting speech, especially when coupled with the other Great Reset initiatives previously discussed, could result in unprecedented and dangerous assaults on speech here in the United States. This is especially true for conservatives and other free speech advocates who are already experiencing the early stages of the left's digital purge of free thinkers, conservative voices, and even some political figures. In the wake of the riots at the U.S. Capitol building in January, which occurred following a rally promoted by President Trump, a long list of social media companies banned Trump from using their service, including Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, and Twitter. But social media platforms didn't stop at President Trump himself. An unprecedented wave of social media bans soon followed that spread well beyond Trump. As the Federalist Joy Pullman noted in a January 2021 column, the purge wasn't at all limited to Trump himself. It's also pursuing his supporters. YouTube banned all videos discussing voter fraud. Reddit shut down its Donald Trump subreddit. On January 8th, Facebook shut down the Walkaway campaign that shared the stories of people who left the Democratic Party to vote for Trump, and banned every one of the group's owners from using Facebook. 381. Facebook also permanently banned clothing retailer Patriotic Me from advertising any of its products on its platform, apparently for violating some unknown Facebook community standard. To give you the sense of some of the dangerous products offered by Patriotic Me, read the following description of the site by one reporter covering the ban. Quote, the apparel sold by Patriotic Me has, well, an obvious patriotic flair. These are shirts adorned with red, white, blue, or an outline of the United States, hoodies with the American flag, hats you could proudly wear to your 4th of July cookout, and every other day, too, just because you love America. 382. According to the same reporter, a portion of every single sale made on Patriotic Me is donated to the Tunnel to Towers Foundation, a charity founded to honor the sacrifice of New York City firefighter Stephen Siller, who gave his life to save others as a first responder on September 11, 2001. Tunnel to Towers provides mortgage-free smart homes to veterans or first responders with catastrophic injuries suffered in the line of duty, or to Gold Star families with surviving spouses and young children, end quote. Oh my gosh, let me take a minute. What monsters, right? I am sure glad Facebook is cracking down on the sale of all those violence-inducing hoodies with the outline of America. Woo! Can you imagine all of that dirty money then going to help veterans and first responders gain access to mortgage-free homes? Huh. Then there was AR15.com. The biggest gun forum in the world, AR15.com, committed the unspeakable crime of letting law-abiding Americans talk online about firearms and gun ownership, a constitutionally protected, God-given right, by the way. Hosting company GoDaddy suddenly just terminated access to the website in January 21 for allegedly violating GoDaddy's terms of service without providing any detailed explanation for the decision or the ability to appeal. But as bad as these attacks on speech were, they pale in comparison to the shocking treatment of Parler, an online social media platform similar to Twitter. In 2018, after years of social media companies deplatforming, mistreating, and unfairly targeting conservatives, including many of the people who work for me at my media company, Blaze Media, John Madz and Jared Thompson launched a new platform. They called it Parler. Unlike establishment social media platforms such as Facebook and Twitter, Parler promised to protect users' privacy and promote free speech by allowing voices from all walks of life to share their political, religious, or ideological views without fear of being punished by big tech or its flawed algorithms. Rather than rely on unaccountable speech police at companies like Google and Facebook, Parler empowered users with a wealth of tools to customize their experience on the platform. Contrary to what you will read in dishonest, so-called mainstream media outlets, Parler was not a conservative social media platform. Anyone can join. Many people who did join were not conservative. Parler's rise to prominence was nothing short of amazing. After initially numbering only thousands of users, Parler's user list skyrocketed into the millions in just 2 years of its launch. In July 2020, Parler reported 2.8 million users, and by early November 2020, the app reported 8 million users. In the week following the 2020 election alone, Parler gained more than 3.5 million users, putting it at the top of Apple's App Store list of free apps. Now, by the end of November, the number of users on Parler hit 10 million. And at the conclusion of 2020, the app's user base was on track to hit 20 million in 2021. Countless media outlets, politicians, radio hosts had joined in 2020, myself included. On Apple's iOS App Store, the application used by every single iPhone user in the world to download new applications for their phone, Parler had recorded a whopping 8.1 million new installs in 2020. Making it the 10th most downloaded social media application in the store over the course of a year. Parler was well on its way to becoming a real competitor to the establishment social media giants at the start of 2021, with some analysts anticipating the value of the company could soon be $1 billion or more. But all of that soon changed. The New York Times recorded the incredible chain of events in January 13 news report. See, I told you I read the New York Times, which noted, by Saturday morning, Apple listed Parler as the number one free app for its iPhones. But by Saturday night, Parler was suddenly fighting for its life. The Times further reported, quote, first Apple and Google removed the app from their app stores because they said it had not sufficiently policed its users' posts, allowing too many that encouraged violence and crime. Then, late Saturday, Amazon told Parler that it would boot the company from its web hosting service on Sunday night because of repeated violations of Amazon's rules. Amazon's move meant that Parler's entire platform would soon go offline unless it was able to find a new hosting service on Sunday. The Sunday deadline came and went as expected. Amazon shut Parler down. Parler initially anticipated it could quickly shift its operations to an Amazon competitor, but one web hosting service after another refused Parler's business, and it was not long before other third-party vendors and businesses also banned Parler from using their services. Within just 1 week of the moves by Apple, Google, and Amazon, three of the wealthiest, most powerful companies on the planet, all of which are run by people hostile to conservative ideas, Parler's CEO announced that one of the only services the platform still had up and running was its company's email account. Now, the justification used by big tech to attack the country's most popular social media outlet, guaranteeing free speech, is that Parler had not done enough to remove posts considered dangerous by Amazon, Apple, and Google. The legacy media was quick to come to the aid of these tech tyrants, insisting, often without providing any evidence, that Parler had become a bastion of hate and extremism. Well, contrary to the unfair characterizations of Parler appearing in many biased media outlets, Parler did not and does not now allow users to post literally anything they want. Parler's terms of service prohibits all sorts of material considered harmful to the platform's community. In a July 2020 article for the left-leaning online publication, The Conversation, academic Audrey Cortry reviewed Parler's terms of service and community standards and found a closer look at its user agreement suggests it moderates content the same way as any platform and maybe even more, end quote. Courtney also noted, Parler's community guidelines prohibit a range of content, including spam, terrorism, unsolicited ads, defamation, blackmail, bribery, and criminal behavior. Although there are no explicit rules against hate speech, there are policies against fighting words and threats of harm. This includes a threat of or advocating for violation against an individual or group. There are rules against content that is obscene, sexual, or, quote, lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value, end quote. For example, just visuals of genitalia, female nipples, or fecal matter are barred from Parler. Cordy's analysis is generally in line with other reports by media about Parler that were published throughout 2020. Numerous media outlets went out of their way to talk about how, even though Parler's marketing campaign presented the platform as a free speech haven, Parler also frequently moderated content considered extremely offensive or violent. Some critics of Parler even suggested the platform was hypocritical for doing so. Newsweek published an article titled, Parler, the Ted Cruz-approved free speech app, is already banning users. Fortune.com posted an article in July 2020 called Conservative Social Media Darling Parler Discovers That Free Speech is Messy, end quote. Washington Post published a piece called The Conservative Alternative to Twitter Wants to Be a Place for Free Speech for All, but it turns out rules still apply. It was not until Parler's popularity soared to even greater heights that the platform suddenly became, in the eyes of the media, an ultra-violent website that must be closed down because, according to the press, only radical extremists use it. In addition to being misleading and or factually incorrect, many of the criticisms leveled against Parler in 2021 were wildly hypocritical. It is true that there were, and probably still are, some vile, disgusting, and violent posts on Parler. And I do believe Parler should do all it can to remove such content and to do it more quickly. Parler officials themselves admitted that they had a backlog of thousands of complaints at the time Amazon took down the site. However, it is also true that Facebook, Twitter, and Google regularly hosted equally vile, disgusting, and violent rhetoric. No one knows this better than I do. Well, Donald Trump, and then maybe me. My family and I have been subject to tens of thousands of threats, personal attacks, foul insults over the years through my social media platforms. And that's just counting the mean stuff my producer has written about me. I have not seen a shred of evidence to suggest that Facebook and Twitter have permanently banned all the users who posted this material about me, my staff, or my family, much of which I'm sure violates their community standards. And I know for a fact that Stu is still allowed to post his nonsensical rantings all over the internet. Facebook, Google, and Twitter have also routinely been used by violent groups to stage riots and events meant to cause destruction and impose fear, including groups associated with the January 2021 Capitol Hill riot. Further, there is no denying that social media platforms like Twitter and Facebook have in some cases gone out of their way to protect accounts controlled by truly dangerous political or social leaders. Take, for example, the Twitter account of the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. This is the supreme dictator, the supreme leader of Iran, a country that has for decades violated human rights, supported terrorism, destabilized the Middle East, even waged a stealth war against the United States, had just put out a hit on Donald Trump. While accounts and tweets from conservatives are being banned by Twitter's thought police in 2020 and 2021, Khamenei's account and its many violent tweets, they're fine. They remain intact, including one from 2018 that reads, "Our stance against Israel is the same stance we have always taken. Hashtag Israel is a malignant cancerous tumor in the West Asian region that has to be removed and eradicated. It is possible and it will happen," end quote. I mean, are there any Twitter, any standards there that maybe Khamenei violated with that one? Or perhaps calling for the genocide of a historically abused religious and ethnic group doesn't mean as much to Twitter. I suppose it's true Khamenei could be worse in the eyes of social media speech police. At least he didn't vote for Donald Trump, right? Further, Twitter continues to allow radicals like Louis Farrakhan and Chinese propagandists to regularly spew false information to their huge social media followings. And Twitter and other social media giants have also refused to warn readers when pundits spread demonstrably false information and conspiracy theories about Russian collusion, including claims that were wildly debunked years ago. They have also chosen not to silence politicians who have openly called for people to harass government officials in the Trump administration and conservative public figures, nor have they banned users who openly sympathized with the rioters who burned and looted cities throughout the summer of 2020. In 2018, Congresswoman Maxine Waters told her supporters, "If you see anyone from that cabinet in that Trump administration, in a restaurant, in a department store, at a gasoline station, you get out and you create a crowd and you push back on them and you tell them you're not welcome anymore anywhere." Well, I am a doctor and a writer, so I should listen to my opinion on this, but that sure sounds like Representative Waters is inciting criminal activity, doesn't it? Yet Twitter continues to allow Maxine to engage with her 1.6 million followers on its platform every day. CNN host Chris Cuomo, the brother of Andrew Cuomo, everyone's least favorite Sopranos character, and one of the worst governors in American history, said in the midst of a period of widespread rioting and looting in the summer of 2020, quote, "And please show me where it says protesters are supposed to be polite and peaceful, because I can show you that outraged citizens are what made the country and what she is and led to any major milestone. To be honest, this isn't a tranquil time," end quote. That's weird that he said that, and yet Chris Cuomo is still able to communicate with his 2.1 million Twitter followers every single day. In waging its war on Parler, big tech could not have been clearer. If you are a free speech-friendly platform that tries to limit violent speech, but struggles, like all social media companies, to root out every single vile post, you deserve to be destroyed. But if you're a media outlet or platform that allows or promotes dangerous, reckless, or misleading information, but generally still favors and promotes causes that the ruling class elites and their allies, those things that they like, well, then you deserve special legal protection that allows big tech investors to earn billions of dollars and amass unprecedented amounts of power. Welcome to the start of the Great Reset, ladies and gentlemen. Some Americans on the left, even some libertarians on the right, argue that Americans should not be concerned about digital crackdowns on speech. We are frequently told private companies can do whatever they want to control speech on their platforms. It's a free market. But the truth is, there is nothing free about big tech's actions. And there won't be anything free market about a great reset ESG system that awards woke companies for stifling speech. Companies will merely be acting to stay on the good side of government and big financial institutions, as many do now, because that is where the money will be in a world dominated by ESG scores and modern monetary theorists like Stephanie Kelton. When confronted with arguments alleging that anyone who stands against big tech tyrants is working against the free market capitalism, it is important to remember that corporations, whether they be massive online retailers or social media giants like Facebook, are themselves the products of government. Not only are corporations subject to countless regulations governing their behavior, but they are also made possible only by special laws that do not exist in a marketplace free of government interference. Big corporations do not pay the same tax rates as individuals. They don't operate under many of the same rules as individuals or face the same legal liabilities as individuals. And that is especially true of numerous large technology companies, which in countless cases are able to exist only because federal law allows them to avoid the lawsuits when users post illegal or defamatory content on their platforms. There used to be a time when even many elites understood that corporations should not have unlimited power. Consider the following quote from the opinion issued in 1946 by the Supreme Court in Marsh versus Alabama, a case in which the court determined that a private corporation could not prohibit a Jehovah's Witness from distributing religious materials in a company-owned town because the ban was in violation of the First Amendment. Quote, ownership does not always mean absolute dominion, wrote Hugo Black, a justice appointed, by the way, by one of the 20th century's most progressive presidents, Franklin Roosevelt. Quote, the more an owner, for his own advantage, opens up his property for use by the public in general, the more do his rights become circumscribed by the statutory and constitutional rights of those who use it. Thus, the owners of privately held bridges, ferries, turnpikes, and railroads may not operate them as freely as a farmer does on his farm. Make no mistake about it. Large corporations ought to be given a great deal of authority over their products, services, and property. But it should never be forgotten that corporations are not divine institutions fully endowed with inalienable rights, but rather creations of government that exist to offer to the public, everyone in the public, goods and services. There is no reason why they should have the power to silence political or religious speech. Americans who are demanding that corporations be required to promote individual rights as a condition of having access to special legal protections ought not to feel even slightly ashamed for doing so. It can't happen here. Wait, can it? When I talk to others about the Great Reset, I am often met at first with a healthy dose of skepticism. And I do mean it. It is good. It's healthy to question. Not only is all of that stakeholder capitalist language misleading and confusing, but many people also have difficulty accepting that something like the Reset really could happen in America. I mean, this is, after all, the home of the largest, most powerful financial markets on the planet, the world's most profitable companies, and the biggest and best economic engine humankind has ever seen. Yeah, Glenn, we get it. Those Europeans love big government systems and elitism, and they've cozied up to fascism before. But America's not Europe. What are you so worried about? Well, in addition to snakes and those really huge spiders in Australia, because those things freak me out, I am worried that many of the leaders of the biggest institutions in the world, from the United Nations and the International Monetary Fund, to multi-billion dollar corporations on Wall Street, have started adopting many of the Great Reset's principles and promoting its expansion, and that many of the people involved are American and have already started to promote the reset in the United States. In fact, according to a report by KPMG, thousands of companies located in more than 50 countries have ESG systems in place, including 82% of large companies in the United States. It's a conspiracy? 82% already have it. Further, American financial institutions have already built massive ESG databases to track and even predict companies' ESG scores. Moody's database has more than 140 million company ESG scores, covering 220 countries. And now it sells a tool to help banks, corporations, and other institutions predict the ESG scores of small and medium-sized companies around the world. Gee, I wonder if I have a good score. Including countless companies that have never once submitted ESG data or reports. So that means if you don't turn an ESGN report into Moody's, it just might invent one for you, whether you like it or not, or whether it's accurate or not. Most important, although it has not received nearly enough media attention, shocking, I know many politicians, activists, and bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. They support the Great Reset policies and are deeply committed to making them a reality, even if they do not typically use the Great Reset slogan on the campaign trail or in the halls of Congress. But first among them, President Joe Biden. The Biden administration and his allies are not merely calling for Great Reset policies. They've already started to put in place the policy and regulatory framework necessary to make the Great Reset a reality. And they have done so at a speed at the end of the Trump administration almost no one thought was possible. So how exactly are the Biden administration and other elites planning on altering American society in line with the Great Reset principles? That is the subject of the next chapter.